India should be a key development partner for Afghanistan. This is a role that India is willing to play. It's willing to step up.
U.S. Secretary of State visits India, boosting relations and discussing security. It's Thursday, October 26th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Xi Jinping becomes one of China's most powerful leaders. Continued pressure on China to rein in North Korea. Has the Philippines overcome an insurgent threat? Strengthening lazy eyes and friendly dogs. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Wednesday met with Indian leaders, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in New Delhi, during a visit that highlighted the strong emergence alliance between the two countries. Combating terrorism and India's role in helping Afghanistan's development were key issues discussed by Indian Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj and Tillerson, who arrived in the capital city after stops in Kabul and Islamabad. Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi describes to International Edition's Sarah Williams how India is expected to play its part in the new South Asia strategy promoted by the United States.
I think India is expected to play a far bigger role in this new strategy than it was earlier. India has been a development partner with Afghanistan for a long time now, for 16 years, you know. But I think that role was limited to some extent because Pakistan did not want India to play a very large role in Afghanistan or have great influence there. The U.S. now, however, in the new U.S. South Asia strategy that it has outlined, says India should be a key development partner for Afghanistan. This is a role that India is willing to play. It's willing to step up. It has already announced 116 new development projects in the region. These are in areas such as health, education, etc., you know, water projects that will help the country get back on its feet economically. So there is a larger role envisaged for India. It's a role India is willing and able to do.
But Indian officials have been expressing their continuing concerns with Pakistan in the area of terrorism.
Absolutely. That is India's biggest concern. India blames Pakistan for harboring and sheltering and giving safe havens to terror groups that they say promote insurgency in India, especially in the northern region of Kashmir, the territory that's disputed between the two countries. This has been a long-standing complaint of India, and it has been wanting more international pressure on Pakistan to act against these terror groups. I think this is where India really welcomes the new South Asia strategy, because the Trump administration has now put that pressure on Pakistan. It is calling on Pakistan to eliminate terror havens, to act against terrorist groups, and to do much more than, you know, most people perceive it has been doing so far. So India really welcomes this. But at the news conference, what the Indian foreign minister stressed today was that Pakistan must take action against all terror groups. The reference here is that there are different terror groups which act in Kashmir, and there are different ones which promote terrorism in Afghanistan. And India, I think, is trying to give the message to Mr. Tillerson that Pakistan must not be selective in acting against the terror groups, but must try to stamp all of them out.
Secretary Tillerson has said that he sees India as a key partner facing what he considers negative Chinese influence in Asia. How do U.S. officials feel that India can provide a counterweight to China in this regard?
Well, I think India is also a rising power in Asia. You know, it has a big navy, it has a large army, and although it can't match China's influence or China's the size of China's economy and size of China's security forces, it is an important power. And I think this is actually what is bringing the U.S. and India closer together. You know, the U.S. sees India as being able to balance an increasingly assertive China, especially in an alliance with other democracies such as Japan and Australia. And India also welcomes this because India is also very suspicious or very concerned about China's assertiveness in the region. There was a tense border standoff between the two countries recently in the Himalayan borders, you know, between the two countries. And this had raised serious concerns about a conflict. So India also would welcome more U.S. support in this regard.
Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi, speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on voanews.com. Top U.S. diplomats' visit to India highlights strong emergence alliance. China unveils new leadership with no clear successor for Xi Jinping. China's Xi taps low-profile official to take over war on graft. Philippines faces new fights after declaring end to war against Muslim insurgents. Bangladesh, Myanmar journalists face obstacles reporting Rohingya story. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, we invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The just-concluded Chinese Communist Party meeting has left Chinese President Xi Jinping with a level of power not seen since the days when Mao Zedong led the country. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about Xi's elevation with Clayton Duby. He's the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of California in Los Angeles.
There's just no question that this is Xi's parade. Xi Jinping is very much in command. If you look beyond the individuals that were chosen for the Standing Committee of the Politburo to the wider Politburo, the vast majority of them, something like two-thirds of them, have a personal connection to Xi Jinping. So it sounds as though factional alignments are a thing of the past, and now you really have him as the dominant figure. At the same time, you also have the idea of party dominance, a reassertion of the centrality of the party and the importance of maintaining a strong party presence in the economy and elsewhere, and reasserting the center's control both over the party and the military that it runs.
There seems to be no obvious successor. You take a look at the age of the people also named to the standing committee. There are a lot of old guys there.
Yes, that would be the case, that none of the individuals included in the Standing Committee could assume the mantle of General Secretary. There are, however, individuals among the Politburo who could be elevated. That doesn't fit the pattern that has existed for the last couple of rounds, where Hu Jintao was first elevated to the Politburo Standing Committee and then became General Secretary, and where Xi Jinping was first elevated to the Politburo Standing Committee and then became General Secretary. So we do have what appears to be a break in that. It's also possible, since this is not part of the party constitution, that Xi Jinping would have to step down in 2022, that he might elect to continue. He certainly, at this point, has the backing to do that.
Let me move on to another issue, that being the inclusion of the thoughts of Xi Jinping into the Constitution of China. The only other Chinese leader to which that was afforded was Mao. That might bring up some questions and some fears to people outside of China. Should they be afraid of too much of a central power and what might happen, especially looking back at Mao Zedong?
I don't believe that Xi Jinping is Mao Zedong part two. I think Xi Jinping is a Leninist and, in fact, asserts the dominance of the party and his dominance over that party. And Mao certainly wanted that. But, in fact, he launched the Cultural Revolution because he thought he had lost control of the party. He wanted to reach beyond the party and turn the public, and especially young people, against the bureaucratization of the party. And so he sought that kind of change. Also, the Communist Party that Xi Jinping leads has already undergone a tremendous transformation. It no longer is focused on, as Mao would have had it, class struggle, on a socialist revolution in the sense of eradicating inequality and things like that. It's very much focused on building China ever stronger, ever more powerful. And so Xi Jinping is a Leninist of the first order. so was Deng Xiaoping. Elevating his thought, attaching his name to it, simply just confirms that he is, unlike his predecessors, Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, very much the person in command.
Clayton Doobie, the director of the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Clay, as always, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. officials have declined to refer to violence against Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar as ethnic cleansing before they complete a review into the issue. Pressure has mounted for a tougher U.S. response to the Rohingya crisis ahead of President Donald Trump's first visit to Asia next month. This story and more are online at VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you so much for listening. A senior White House official says when Donald Trump visits China next month, the president will urge his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping to make good on his commitments to pressure North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs. The official said Beijing needs to do more to comply with two previous UN Security Council resolutions approved unanimously. At a Southeast Asian security meeting Monday, Japan's defense minister warned the threat posed by North Korea has grown to a critical and imminent level. Pyongyang has fired missile tests over Japanese territory. But Tufts University assistant professor in Korean studies, Sung Yun Lee, tells VOA's Victor Beatty such a warning could have been made years ago.
You could have said that 1 year ago, or even 5 years ago. But this year, 2017, North Korea has really removed all doubt by conducting two successful ICBM tests in the month of July and the nation's most powerful nuclear test to date in early September. So I suppose the learning curve has been not very impressive, but it's good that all the powers in the region, allies of the United States, now take the view that it's really not in anyone's interest, except for North Korea's, to kick the can further down the road. Something needs to be done. There's a sense of urgency, which is quite necessary and positive. The question remains, what will the U.S. and its allies and China, which of course is the key player in terms of reining North Korea in, what will all these powers do? And this is a part of outreach, diplomatic activity, if you will. Of course, diplomacy encompasses military posturing and conventional military defense as well. Diplomacy is not exclusively just talking. You need to have a power base for diplomacy to be effective. And this is an effort by the U.S. to try to thwart another major provocation in the days, weeks leading up to President Donald Trump's very important visit to East Asia in early November.
Here in Washington, Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong said that pressure is necessary on North Korea, but so is dialogue. The U.S. will need to work with others, including China, South Korea, and Japan and Russia, to resolve the issue.
Well, that's true, of course, and there will come a time for dialogue because it's not in anyone's interest to continue to climb up the ladder of escalation, tit for tat with North Korea. It's not in North Korea's interest either. However, what is unnerving slightly is that in the past, it's always been North Korea that has been calling the tunes, calling for dialogue or really driving the series of escalation. North Korea has been wielding the carrot and stick. And when North Korea makes a dramatic gesture of peace, for example, even announcing it will send athletes to the Winter Olympiad in South Korea in February, that will change the atmospherics and that will be perhaps seen by many around the world as a time for genuine dialogue. In my view, that would be falling for the same old trap once again.
Clayton Doobie speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia as part of a high-level security summit in the Philippines. U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis is holding bilateral talks with Malaysian, Indian, and Indonesian counterparts and has praised the Philippine military assault against suspected Islamic State militants in Marawi. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA. As VOA Asia continues, this week after the Philippines declared an end to Islamic State's control of the southern city of Marawi, Australia announced it is expanding its security support to Manila to focus on urban counterterrorism training. Maurice Payne, Australia's defense minister, spoke on the sidelines of an annual meeting of Southeast Asian defense officials in the Philippines.
The ADF will provide mobile training teams that will begin providing urban warfare, counter-terrorism training in the Philippines in the coming days. When you think about people who have been part of the Daesh campaigns in Iraq and Syria, they are battle-trained, they are battle-hardened, they are extremists of the highest order who have been prepared to do the most appalling things, using civilians as human shields, using civilians as collateral in their efforts to try and pursue their perverted ideology.
Australia and other Asian countries are trying to keep track of returning militants who fought in Iraq and Syria, many identified as Indonesian, Malaysian, and Filipino. Despite U.S. and Australian assistance, it took the Philippine Army 5 months to retake the city on Mindanao and left more than 1,100 dead and hundreds of thousands displaced. Gerard Finnan, senior fellow at the East-West Institute in Hawaii, tells VOA the fall of Marawi appeared to have undercut the view that President Rodrigo Duterte's roots in Mindanao, a former mayor of Davao City, would be an asset in bringing about peace and order.
So the government's sudden loss of control of Marawi City was therefore a huge embarrassment to his administration. And as you say, the fact that it took some 5 months to regain control, as well as Chinese rifles and U.S. military support, undermined Mr. Duterte's image as a strong leader. You may recall he also declared martial law in Mindanao, but this did not seem to make a significant difference in bringing the conflict to a close.
The incursion raises concerns that Islamic State is making advances to establish a foothold in Southeast Asia, specifically in the southern Philippines.
It's really unclear at this point to what extent the local and foreign fighters who were responsible for the siege have gotten away to launch similar raids in the future. If you read the reports from the Philippine government, they say that they've rounded up or killed everyone. But my own sense is that things may be quiet today, but it's highly unlikely that we will not hear from pro-Islamic State fighters in the future.
Regardless, Finnan says the decades-long struggle with Muslim insurgents remains an issue for the country.
It's an ongoing challenge, and one that was faced by the Spanish and the Americans during colonial times and by the Independent Republic of the Philippines since 1946. But I think it is important to note that there has not been a takeover of a Philippine city like this in a very long time. And so, once again, this was a huge embarrassment for a president who tries to portray himself as a strong and decisive leader. I think it also shows that Mr. Duterte's decision to ignore or circumvent the rule of law in the Philippines to achieve results has fallen far short of the promises that were made when he took office.
Media reports indicate that President Donald Trump will meet his Philippine counterpart during his first Asian trip as president next week, and human rights may be on the agenda. Mr. Duterte has been accused of overseeing rights abuses in his country's war on drugs. This news alert from VOA Asia, the extravagant 5-day funeral ceremony for Thailand's late king who died last year has begun with large crowds of black-clad mourners braving tropical downpours along a procession route in Bangkok. For millions of Thai people, it is the first funeral of a ruling monarch of their lifetimes. Stay up to date every day at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, amblyopia is a Greek word that means blunt vision. It's often called lazy eye, and it's one of the most common vision problems in children. Amblyopia is usually treatable, but left untreated, it can affect a child's reading and fine motor skills or even cause blindness. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on a new type of treatment for children with this condition that shows a lot of promise.
Amblyopia, or lazy eye, affects about 3 out of every 100 children, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. A child with amblyopia may appear normal, but one eye sends stronger signals to the brain than the other one does. If it is left untreated, the pathways the weaker eye uses to send signals can weaken further or may not develop properly. Doctors commonly treat the condition with a patch over the strong eye to force the weak eye to develop, but this treatment may not make the eyes work together. A child may end up using one eye for distance and the other for seeing close-up. At the Retina Foundation of the Southwest, Dr. Krista Kelly and other researchers wanted to see if they could improve on the standard treatment given to children with this condition.
Amblyopia not only has deficits in vision, but it causes deficits in 3D depth perception, reading, and fine motor skills.
These deficits can last through adulthood. Without three-dimensional vision, a person's ability to drive a car, read a newspaper, and generally see the world can remain impaired. But now there's a new way to treat this condition. Researchers gave children with amblyopia an iPad and a pair of glasses and had them play a specially developed video game. The glasses changed the way the children saw things. They had to work the weaker eye harder in order to play the game, which also forced the children to work both eyes together. Another group of children with amblyopia was only given the patch. After 2 weeks, Kelly said both groups were evaluated.
We found that at the 2-week visit, children who had the iPad game improved vision much more than children who patched.
The children who played the iPad games had improved so much that the researchers gave the iPad and the game to both groups of children. The study appeared in JAMA Ophthalmology. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. researchers have identified a key genetic difference between dogs and their wild cousins, wolves. Faith Lapidus tells us the difference could explain why dogs are so friendly.
A new study shows that today's friendly pups are the result of generations of domestication and genetics.
I happened to make contact with Bridget von Holt, who is a professor at Princeton University, and she had recently discovered a genetic divergence between dogs and wolves that was located in the same area that had previously been implicated in the development of something called Williams-Buren syndrome in humans.
One of the characteristics of that rare congenital disorder is an excessively friendly and outgoing personality. Williams syndrome, as it's also known, is caused by genetic mutations in a specific region of chromosome 7. That's equivalent to the region in the canine genome associated with sociability. The variation in those genes led to the pro-social behavior of domestic dogs, who are friendlier even than wolves raised by humans.
Where dogs and wolves are both interested in people, wolves will typically come, engage in a short sort of adult-type greeting, and then move on back to their normal behaviors, whereas dogs will come and greet a person and greet them again and continue to greet them, whether or not that person is reciprocating that affection. And in some cases, they'll be just as enthusiastic with strangers as they are with their own owners.
The study by Udell and von Holt, published in Science Advances, confirms that both nature and nurture played a role in making our best friends as friendly as they are. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download us as a podcast and take VOA Asia with you. We'd also like to hear from you. You can write to us on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also send us an email. Our address is voaasia@voanews.com. We're heard on many great radio stations like DZUP 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, Quezon City, Philippines. Thanks to everyone there who's joined us today. We thank, too, our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Thomas Blondet, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.